Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we tackle home renovation and repair issues. And if you'd like to have a question answered, then all you have to do is give us a call. Our statewide number, 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Here with me in the studio is John Viner of Building Services and Consultant, LLC, Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. John, a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jim.
And on the telephone with us is Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, a full-service residential remodeling company specializing in sustainable design and historic renovations. Chad, thanks so much for joining in from, where are you, New York City?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm out in Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore.
The National Association of the Remodeling Industry is having its fall board meeting out here, and we just wrapped up about an hour ago. So.
Sounds good. Well, good to have you with us. And if people, I say, have questions that they need answered, call us at 1-800-642-1234. We have lines open for you right now. Should mention right at the start that September 15th is the deadline for people living in the southern half of Wisconsin who have mold and water problems from the May-June storms to register with FEMA. You do that at 800-621-3362 or at fema.gov. And I would imagine, Chad, that you're well aware of people who have mold and water issues from those storms.
Yes, I've looked at more projects than I'd like to recount, certainly. It's been a tough year for a lot of people.
And how about for you, John? Do you see those kinds of issues in the work that you're doing?
I do not see a large amount of where we have a lot of standing water or foot deep in the basement, large moisture concerns such as that. I will defer those. My role is preventative from coming from landscaping, simply rainwater, indoor moisture generation, and how do we control that humidity, window condensation, for example, those types of problems.
Mm-hmm. Focus on Energy, Wisconsin's Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Program, is seeking applicants for its Targeted Home Performance with Energy Star program, which offers limited-income homeowners low-cost efficiency improvements to improve the comfort, safety, and affordability of their homes. This is where you come in, John, isn't it?
Well, on the Targeted Home Performance Program, that is an income-eligible program that I do not work closely with. I work with the Standard Home Performance with Energy Star program, helping homeowners for a fee service.
Mm-hmm.
The targeted program is an excellent way for folks that meet that income eligibility. I don't have that chart in front of me, but I know that
I saw it. It's between $30,975 to $41,300 for a family of four who are customers of participating natural gas and electricity providers.
There we go.
So those are the income limits.
Yep, for that family of four. And the improvements, weatherization, but also mechanical changes as well, heating, air conditioning, water heating, where you know, up to 90% of the cost is paid through that program, and the services are provided generally through low-income weatherization providers.
All right. So if you need some information about that, focusonenergy.com or 800-762-7077, and we'll repeat those numbers and the FEMA number as we go along in the show. But Chad and John, let's take some phone calls, and we're going to start off with Scott in Eau Claire. Scott, what's on your mind this morning?
Yeah, I got a question about our pantry. All three walls face exterior, not right exterior, like to the back wall and the left wall go into the garage. And the right wall goes into a three-season porch, and it's all sheetrocked and insulated already. But in the wintertime, it gets so cold, and they would have to put a towel down on the bottom of the door, and we just keep our pop in there, and sometimes it actually freezes.
Mm.
And I want to fix it for this year, but I don't really know how to go about it since there's already insulation in there before I start ripping things out.
Well, I can speak to that a little bit, Scott. I mean, what often happens there could be a variety of things. Is this over a crawl space, or is it does the basement extend out into this little pantryway?
No.
Okay. So, you know, what's going to need to happen when you say there's insulation out there already? How do you know that, or what have you?
I went from the garage side and drilled a little hole in there.
Okay.
And took a clothes hanger and kind of picked around and seen that there was fiberglass insulation in there.
Okay. So and that would be in the walls.
Right.
So what we don't know is whether or not the floor and the ceiling are well insulated, and it sounds like it's possible that they are not. It's also possible that there's insulation in all the cavities, but that there are a lot of spaces where air can flow in and around that insulation. And what we have there is a situation where, as is often the case, bat insulation has been installed in those cavities, but there really hasn't been any air sealing done, and the insulation itself is installed in such a way that it's allowing cold air to flow in and around the surfaces, and it's not really performing as a result of that. One of the big problems with roll-out bat insulation, which is the type of insulation most of us are familiar with from do-it-yourself projects, and if you go to the big box store to buy insulation, most of what they sell is a bat insulation. Most builders install that sort of insulation. It has to be installed very precisely to fill the exact cavity that's being insulated, and that's not often done. And so, you know, the symptoms that you're experiencing are likely the result of a combination of poor air sealing and inadequate insulation. Now, there are a couple of things you can do. I mean, I would recommend that you try to gain access to the underside of the floor to see to it that that is properly insulated, that all those cavities are filled up with insulation, and that any penetrations in the that perimeter of the room be sealed up with caulk or foam, so that you have a really tight, well-insulated floor. Similarly, if there's a way to look at the ceiling, you'd want to do that as well. And, of course, if it's possible to kind of start over and gut the room, if you find that the problem persists, that may have to happen. A lot of times, you know, little details that aren't done well on a room that's surrounded on five sides by, you know, a Wisconsin winter, that can really lead to, you know, an uncomfortable space. So you may find that you have to go further than just some little details. And I don't know, John, if you have some things to add to that.
Well, those are all good suggestions. It sounds like maybe it's on a slab inside there or the cold crawl space, but certainly we need heat in there. Is there a source of heat in that small pantry?
Actually, 'cause right under the pantry, there's ductwork to heat the garage, and I heat the garage, but not, you know, just enough to melt the snow and stuff so it doesn't ice up on the windshield overnight, because right under that floor is ductwork to heat my garage, and that's just kind of why I'm kind of puzzled, because, you know, there's always a little bit, I have the damper, you know, open just enough, but there's heat coming through it, but that pantry just stays so cold yet.
Yeah, so the ductwork heats the garage, but there's no dedicated supply register for that pantry?
No.
Yeah, so if we're not putting heat in there, we're going to lose heat. So certainly the air sealing, and if you got heat going through the garage where that duct penetrates the garage, is going to be one of those sources of air leaks that Chad is referring to. But regardless, we have a door with a small pantry and no heat inside there. We're going to keep it cool until we can have, say, a louvered door, keep that area opened up to the rest of the house and supply a little bit of heat in there, and maybe that's possible. Talk to your heating contractor about connecting a dedicated supply register from that duct system.
Scott, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. The number for your call is 1-800-642-1234 here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Martha next in Baraboo. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I have a question about re-roofing. We have basically a traditional Cape sort of a house with about a 7 or 8 and 12 slope, and my husband just told me, well, you know, we need to re-roof because the shingles are getting really battered on the south side. And I was wondering about the about metal roofing and what its pluses and minuses are and all that sort of thing, whether it would be appropriate and whether it would last longer and all that kind of stuff, and I can take my answer off the air.
Yeah, well, metal roofing is something that's been around for a long time, and once you invest in a metal roof, you've got what we like to call a 100-year roof. Generally, that metal roof may require some maintenance, some recoating a couple of times over its life, but basically the material itself, if properly maintained, will last approximately 100 years. What we have found when we have looked into putting metal roofing on homes for some of our clients is that it generally is going to cost about four times what a traditional asphalt three-tab shingle roof will cost. And so that's a roof that's designed to last 20 to 25 years, so you really are paying, you know, for four times the life of the roof, you're going to pay about four times as much, consistent with what you might expect. One of the big advantages to a metal roof is just that it's more resource efficient. Instead of putting on and tearing off four roofs over that 100-year span, you're able to put one roof on and have it last that 100 years. If you have a well-built home that you have no reason to believe isn't up to the task of 100 more years, you know, you would be a good steward of that property to consider the metal roof. The downside is that, you know, it's a big investment. If the house gets altered in some way, an addition put on, things like that, you know, you're going to be having to undo or possibly alter that metal roof that, you know, you've invested in. But I think that it's definitely something worth considering. You know, if you were looking, say, at a copper roof, then you're looking at considerably more money. But what typically is done is just a painted steel roof. And like I say, with proper maintenance, it can last a long time.
Martha? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Bob in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
I've got two questions regarding attic venting, and they're kind of related. The first question is there some desired ratio of square inches of rooftop venting versus the total square footage of the roof? And the related question is, once you've come up with the right number, say of pot vents for the size of your roof, then what's the recommended ratio of soffit vent area to ridge vent area? And I'll hang on.
Okay. Attic venting, Wisconsin code actually asks for 1 square foot of net free area of attic venting to every 300 square feet of ceiling area. So we're just taking the upper floor, the top floor, ceiling area, and we're going 1 to 300. And then we take that figure that we've calculated, and we're splitting it 50%, 50% high, 50% low. Now, that's a minimum requirement for Wisconsin code.
Mm-hmm.
always good. We can go a little bit beyond that, but that is written in Wisconsin, 1 to 300. Now, if we sometimes we can't always get that, and we have to do the best we can with our structure. Certainly with older homes, sometimes we don't have that soffit or that overhang to work with. So 1 to 300 is the minimum.
All right. Thanks very much. I hope that provides the answer for you as we talk today about home renovation and repair issues with Chad Spate and John Viner. I'm Jim Packard. Sarah Carroll is our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network as we talk home renovation and repair issues today with Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner of Building Services and consultant of Mount Horeb. Lines are full, so let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning. I got a question on locks. I have two questions on sliding doors or pocket doors. Mm-hmm. Where can I get? It looks like a skeleton key, but I took the lock out, and the skeleton key won't turn anything. Okay, and where can I go to in Madison? Where would I be able to go in Madison to somebody that would know something about those if I took the lock to them? That's the first question. The second one is, the outer door takes a skeleton key, but it's got two keyholes, and it's got little buttons you push in that lock the doorknob. And I know nothing about it. I took one look at those, and I put them back together because I know nothing about them.
Okay. Well, you know, I would recommend that you call one of a couple of competent locksmiths in town, and there are a few in Madison, and I, you know, can just say that I would recommend you consult the Yellow Pages. I know a few of them will make house calls, and it might be worth having the locksmith come and deal with that second outer door, because generally if I'm thinking of what you're describing, that would be a couple of buttons that are actually on the edge of the door,
right on the, right
where
on
the where the lock is thrown
yeah,
out of
the lock,
the
you
end
push
of the
it
door,
in, you push one
and
in,
those
pop,
buttons
pop.
Allow you to make it so that the outer thumb latch basically is locked when the door is closed. If you hit one of the buttons in and you shut the door, you need a key to get in. If you push the other button, it will make it so that it is unlocked and you can just come and go through the door unless you actually use a key to throw the lock or deadbolt that's a part of that mechanism. You know, that's an older style lock set.
The house dates about 1900.
Okay, and that would be consistent with that time period. And, you know, generally, while I have on a few occasions taken those apart and fooled around with them, I have learned that the locksmith is much better at that than I. And I can say that, again, there are a couple in town. Bill's locksmith comes to mind. There's one right down near the university there that might be able to help you out. And if you were able to disassemble it and take it into them, you know, they might be able to help you with it as well. But sometimes those are so complex that trying to, you know, get them back in the door, because they're a full mortise lock, so there's a large rectangular hole in the edge of the door, and you really can open a can of worms when you dismantle those.
I took one look at it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You
all
bet,
right,
good luck with that.
Viola is going to be a ways away from Madison. I don't see a locksmith making a courtesy call out there, so maybe you have to take the door right with you.
That's a good point.
All right. Let's go to Dorothy next in Black Creek. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. I was calling about a wooden kitchen floor and what you would use to seal the surface so water wouldn't damage it. This is an old, about 1880 farmhouse. The floor is probably maple. Right now it's covered with plywood sheets and lots of linoleum. But if I was to take that covering off and go down to the maple, which would be much prettier, what in the world would I use to seal it so water splashing around wouldn't damage it?
Okay. Well, a couple of things that I just want to bring to your attention. It's quite possible that an old home like that, with all the various layers of old flooring, that you're going to find there's some asbestos in some of that old flooring, and even in some of the old adhesives that might have been used when things were renovated over the years. You know, the original maple flooring is probably fine once you get down to that. But going through the process of demolition is one that, you know, you're going to need to take some precautions. I would recommend having the material, you know, removing a small square of it, or having the contractor remove a small square of it and have it tested for asbestos. So that's one thing. And then as far as the question of refinishing that maple, once you're down to the original wood floor, there again, you know, it's going to need to be sanded, and you'll want to make sure that it's free of any dangerous residue when that happens, because a lot of dust will be created. And once you have it down to a nice new sanded surface, the product that we really like to use and that our finishers reuse is a water-based urethane. It's a water-based polyurethane. It has hardeners in it, and it does an excellent job of protecting and preserving the floor. I refinished an old maple floor in my own 1920s vintage home, and we've done it for many clients. And this particular product, which is not necessarily available easily for the homeowner. I know that it's even difficult sometimes to acquire it as a contractor, but it is a Swedish finish, a waterborne urethane. And the product we normally use is made by a company called Bona, B-O-N-A. That's what I would recommend.
Oh, okay. Hey, and how many layers? One, two, three?
Well, it's good if you can do three layers. You do a very light sanding in between.
Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of wood furnishing myself, but this is a project I wouldn't do.
Well, the nice thing about this product is that it is dry to the touch about 5 minutes after applied, and you can literally walk on it and sock feet in 15 minutes, and often the coats are applied in pretty rapid succession. And once the sanding is completed, it can all be finished with three coats in a matter of an hour.
Super. Hey, thank you very much.
Okay, Dorothy, thank you very much for your call. Home renovation and repair issues are what we're tackling today. Chad Spate, John Viner, our guests, and our number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Paul in Monona had an email question. Do you have any advice on what woods are best for outdoor decks, either covered or uncovered? And could you compare wear and maintenance of pressure-treated southern yellow pine versus cedar?
Well, that's an excellent question. Cedar is going to be a relatively high-maintenance material. A lot of us like cedar. It's a traditional, naturally rot and pest-resistant wood. It is relatively inexpensive, though typically cost about 50% more than the treated southern yellow pine products that are widely available.
Mm-hmm.
The treated pine is going to be your least expensive product, and it can go untreated for a number of years after it's applied. Now, the Wood Forest Products, or Forest Products Lab in Madison, does considerable testing on wood decks, and they used to recommend that for cedar, for example, that cedar be allowed to weather for a period of up to a year. And they no longer give that recommendation. Now they are asking all of us to seal and protect a cedar exterior product within a month of installation. And that's because, frankly, the ultraviolet damage, which has increased over the years is just too severe to justify allowing the wood to further dry out prior to putting on that protective coating. There are some other exotic hardwoods out there that are very popular. They're very durable. The most popular hardwood out there right now is something called Ipe, which is a Brazilian hardwood. You have to pre-drill the fasteners before putting it in. There are a couple of other equally durable products, such as Garapa Gold, another Brazilian or tropical hardwood. I do have some concerns about the sustainability of these products as far as where they're coming from and how they're being harvested. And they're very expensive. But they also, those products, despite their expense and some other questions about them, they also need to be refinished periodically. And we'll generally recommend that a deck be refinished every 2 to 3 years if you really want to maintain a nice finish on it.
Okay. Chad Spate, John Viner, our guests, and let's go next to Peter in Ashland. Peter, what can we do for you?
I just had a comment on the metal roof ideas versus the asphalt. We're doing that up here in the north, and we find that it, so your homeowners aren't deterred away from doing it, we find that it costs about, initially it's about twice as much up here to do it. You're spending a little more on the steel, but you're saving a little bit on the labor because it's not as labor-intensive as shingles. So just so homeowners maybe in our neck of the woods are listening, they don't think it's going to cost them the four times as much, because it hasn't, and unless steel prices continue to rise, I don't think it will in a while. Now, that pertains to the standard 9-inch on center rib steel. If you go to a standing seam or a metal shingle type thing, I could see it being even more than four times as much. But your common metal roof, I would say twice as much at the most. Just wanted to add that in there.
Thanks very much. Chad's taking that into account already. Joe, let's go to you in Fox Point. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, and a great show. Thanks for these programs.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions related to insulation in a ceiling. Number one, I have recessed lighting. I guess they're in like cans that shine down through the ceiling. And in the wintertime, I get cold air coming down through them. I've actually used like saran wrap on the inside surface to seal them up so that the draft, cut the draft. If I can get up in there, is it okay to just put insulation over those, I'll call them cans, I assume they're in some kind of a fixture that sticks up into the attic?
Yeah, so the recessed lights, they come in a couple different ratings. So how old is your home?
Well, it was built in 1959, but it had a lot of renovation work. We've only been here about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that had it before us did a lot of interior work, I'm guessing within the last 5 or 6 years.
So is there is an attic space above those lights, so a person, an individual, could crawl up above those lights, or is it...
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. I did it yesterday, and I'm still trying
to straighten up.
So the draft that you're feeling, of course, is air leakage and something we want to go after. And insulating doesn't always stop that draft. If we want to put a piece of fiberglass bat over the light thinking that we're going to insulate and stop the draft, we may be mistaken. Air sealing, stopping the drafts, often is different than insulating. Because that insulation is very porous, depending on the insulation that you choose. Also, I need to mention that the recessed lights, some have a rating on them to be in contact with insulation, and some are not meant to be in contact with insulation. So you need to pull down the faceplate or look with inside on the interior, generally, of that recessed light, and see if it has a rating that's called IC, the letter I, the letter C, that stands for insulation contact. and it's able to then you can insulate over the top. When it comes to, again, back to stopping those drafts, it is, if we want to utilize that same light, we have a couple options. One is oftentimes in the past they're creating a box over the light and sealing that to the ceiling from the attic space. So we're encapsulating that light because that can is full of perforations to allow for adjustments of that light. The light bulb up and down, how deep do you want it recessed in? It sounds like a difficult place to work, and that might not be a good option for you. Even where we have the greatest conditions, it's difficult in a dirty situation to make that airtight seal. There are recessed light kits available that is an inner sleeve that slides into the existing recessed light, and they're made to change that recessed light designed for an incandescent bulb to better fit a compact fluorescent light. So now we also get a cooler light, and we're able to use a more efficient bulb, and it's an airtight sleeve that slides in, seals it up. We still would like to, we still get air leakage between the can and the sheetrock, so we still caulk between the metal can and your ceiling to stop that air leakage. A location for that recessed light kit is Energy Federation Incorporated, EFI.org, I believe. You should be able to find access to that light.
Great. Energy Federation Incorporated.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. If I may, a quick related question. If insulation becomes damaged by water leaks, we fixed some, we had roof work done and repair around our chimney, so we don't have, it wasn't extensive leakage, but it was water coming in around the edges of the chimney. That's been fixed. Now my question is, do I need to replace that insulation that may have gotten somewhat damp? This was in June when we had all that rain in early June. Or will it dry out by itself? It's it looks like it's that pink bat insulation. Mm-hmm. Although there is some blown in, it looks like blown in insulation below it.
Usually that fiberglass is going to dry out well enough for us, and we're not going to replace that if it's if it got a little wet. I mean, if it got drenched and it's sagging and really looks like a pail of water fell on it, then we might want to replace that, but I wouldn't be concerned about a little bit of wetting.
Okay, great.
All right,
great.
Thanks a lot, Joe. We appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in with your question, the number is 800-642-1234. And on we go to Henry in Minocqua. Henry, what can we do for you?
Yes, I have two quick questions. The first one is, in my house here, underneath the crawl space, I have big heat ducts that have been put in, and the crawl space is probably about 2 feet high and is with a sand base. Then the other section of the house has a basement, which, you know, it's at have two additions here, or additions, and it has a basement. You go out in the basement, down in the basement, that's warmer than the top of the house. I have some 2-inch 4x8 sheets of that blue insulation that they put in, under around the outside of foundations and so forth. I have 2 sheets of those. Could I cut those up and glue those onto those flat hot water, hot heat ducts?
No, I guess I would not recommend using the blue board that you have there on those ducts. There are specific insulation properties or products that are made for insulating on the ducts. We just wouldn't want all that. I think from a fire protection, we don't want all that exposed foam sitting in our basement. We'd rather have something that's going to be a little bit more resistant to fire if an unfortunate event would happen. Is the crawl space where the ducts are located in there insulated in the floor or at the foundation wall?
Well, there is some insulation at the floor, but when the man put the ducts in, of course, he had to tear a lot of insulation out. So,
yeah.
I imagine I'd have to go under there if I could and try to put up more insulation.
Right, right. So there's no designed supply grills in the basement? You're not trying to condition it in any way?
I don't know what you mean by design grills.
Or supply grills. Is there living space down there, finished area too?
In the basement part there is, but underneath the house, no, it's just a 2 foot. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's like two houses put together with an addition.
Okay. Yeah, you kind of have the opposite problem with a lot of people. Basements are a little bit too cold. Everybody would want it a little bit warmer. Certainly the ducts could be still air sealed, still could be beneficial if we want to, our upstairs is uncomfortable, we want to deliver a greater quantity of air to the first floor living areas. Air sealing is first. Then we think about insulating those ducts with a proper insulated duct wrap with an R value of 8 or greater. It usually comes in a foil-faced fiberglass bat or a white vinyl-faced fiberglass bat that's used to insulate those ducts.
Folks at Menards or Home Depot could help me out there.
Possibly.
Okay. Final quick question. I'm plagued on asphalt. I guess they're shingle roofs with moss. It's just impossible. And the question the gentleman was talking about tin roofs. If I were to put it like a tin roof on my garage, would I eliminate moss?
Chad, you got an answer for that?
Well, you know, moss is basically a symptom of dampness, moisture that's not able to dry out properly. Often we see it on heavily shaded rooftops or on the north side of a rooftop. You know, what we generally recommend is there is a zinc strip that can be installed at the top of the roof. That helps to reduce the potential for that moss to grow on the shingles. How old is the roof?
I would think the garage roof now is a good 15 years old now.
Okay. Has it started to curl or
8 years?
Show considerable wear?
No, it doesn't show where, but I had to get up there the other day on the north side and just spend 4 hours just trying to push the moss off and, you know, other debris.
Well, you might want to consult with a roofing contractor that could possibly give you some information on installing this sort of a zinc strip, and it is something that you could potentially purchase and install yourself up near the ridge or along if there are hips on the roof, you know, along the top edge of the hips and the ridge, so that as the water flows down, some of that, it's essentially a chemical reaction that takes place, and it helps to keep the roof a little bit cleaner.
Okay, well, I'll check on the Menards or Home Depot for that, too.
All right.
Thank you.
Henry, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guests today are Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, Wisconsin, John Viner of Building Services and consultant of Mount Horb. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us today as we talk about home renovation and repair issues with Chad Spate and John Viner. If you'd like to join us, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Michael from Racine is talking to contractors about a remodeling project. Prices by square foot are all over the map, from $80 per square foot to over $200 per square foot. I understand that finish and options affect this, but this is for the simple structural requirements, and all have been given the same requirements and drawings to begin with. My question is, with the current housing market slowdown, what are some realistic expectations for remodeling costs? Simple additions, full service additions, new construction. Would you have an idea about that, Chad?
Yeah, well, I can speak to the Madison market. Typically, an addition of a pretty good size, you know, a smaller addition, say something that's 10 feet by 10 feet, this wouldn't necessarily apply because of the economy of scale not being that great. But typically for an addition, say that's sold 400 square feet or more, the low end of that cost is likely to be around $180 or $200 a square foot. And then it's not uncommon for it to push, you know, quite a bit higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
New home construction, the cost can be closer to $130 to $150 a square foot as a low-end cost. There, you know, but as the email alludes to, the analogy I like to give and what it costs to build something or remodel something is, what does it cost to buy a car? That's a good way to think of it. You know, you can go and buy an economy car, something like a Hyundai or something, and you might spend only $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
But you could buy a similar car. It's going to have four wheels, hubcaps, a motor, steering wheel, you know, I mean, all the basic features. But if it's a Lexus, well, you might spend $60,000 or $70,000. Both of them take people places. Both of them have the same basic, you know, features, but there are a lot of amenities and finishes and details and performance-related, you know, attributes that make that Lexus worth a lot more than that Hyundai. And so, you know, remodeling is a lot like that. And you really do often, at the end of the day, get what you pay for, and sometimes it's hard for the consumer to sort out exactly what they're getting.
I think that there's an underlying question here as well, an underlying premise that in the current housing market, that a slowdown would indicate that prices should be dropping. And do you find that to be true, or is that just not happening?
Well, you know, we don't, I mean, I understand how markets affect the cost of materials and things like that with supply and demand, but the cost of labor is something that we haven't seen much of a drop in.
Yeah.
And so to that extent, you know, prices are remaining somewhat steady. Or put another way, you know, the cost of building something doesn't go down because fewer people are asking to build it. Now, there are a lot of people out there that are hungry, that are looking for work, and they are willing to you know, negotiate down their pricing as a result of that. So that's where we do see some downward movement in some pricing from some individuals. But fuel costs are up. That is has been driving over the last year an increase in material cost and an increase in some manufacturing cost. So, you know, those factors have actually worked against any factors relating to demand that would have otherwise brought down pricing on some things more considerably.
Okay. Let's go to the phones again to Cannon in Hudson. And what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm basically just inquiring about geothermal heat. I have a schoolhouse built in 1892. It's a very strong structure, but it's 2,500 square feet, two-story. It's been remodeled now. I had people in. I had a few heating and cooling people come in and just give me estimates on what it would take to put a conventional system in, heating system gas. And they said you might want to consider this option because if you're going to be in the home for a long time, geothermal will, you know, eventually, you know, you'll reap the benefits from it. But I was just curious, has there been any track record or any reports as to the reliability of these systems, and is there a specific manufactured product out there that you want to follow or look at when considering this?
John?
I think geothermal heat pumps have a good track record. They've been around for a lot of years. So I think that with a good installation, just like any heating or air conditioning installation, it's got to be installed and set up properly. And we'll just, once we got that, once we have that, it's going to work a long time for you, and we're using relying on electricity prices and the efficiency of that geothermal heat pump to keep our costs low. obviously.
I understand it takes a lot of green to go green.
Yeah.
I'm prepared for that, but I do think we'll be in this a long time. I'd like to get it back to looking somewhat like schoolhouse-esque,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of am keyed in on the whole idea of going green on something so old, you know, on an older structure that it's actually very a sturdy structure. It's going to last a long time. So,
are you then renovating that schoolhouse where we're removing interior finishes or doing any gutting of the interior?
Eventually, I'm going to take down. I don't know if I'll take down walls, but at least drywall off, re-insulate, update insulation top to bottom.
Yeah, so the
maybe reconfigure the walls a little bit, but
mm-hmm.
all in all, the basic layout, I like the basic layout the way of it is now.
So your resources, just like before we go into and install any renewable energy source, and I'm going to put geothermal in that category, obviously, but we want to make sure we have a high-performance building. That's one. And that's going beyond the code standards, which are minimum standards to have a house that's going to be durable and safe. I'd like to see people put more resources into, for example, continuous foam insulation on the exterior sidewalls, extra detailing in the air sealing of that building, extra detail resources into proper ventilation systems. If we're going to go out and make that a high-performance building, we need a quality ventilation system. Having it safe from maybe removing combustion appliances as a water heater that if you're using propane or natural gas, venting into a vertical masonry chimney where we have some susceptibility of those chimneys not operating properly. So if that's all taken care of first and we have additional resources to put into a quality heating system, a geothermal, I think, can be a great way to go. Manufacturers, I know there's Water Furnace comes to mind as a good quality manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You might also check with the Midwest Renewable Energy Association because I seem to recall that last summer there were several people there on display with the geothermal units.
Now, are there any other types of incentives for putting these types of systems in that were saving energy or...
There really is not much of an incentive. There is none on the federal level. On the state level, I think there is a little bit of an incentive for that geothermal heat pump. Primarily, that incentive is based on the furnace blower. If we get an efficient variable speed blower with that geothermal heat pump, there may be, I think, $150 or some marginal dollar amount for you.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jana in Rice Lake next. Hi, Jana.
Hi. I'm painting cement steps in a high-traffic area. I'm using a latex floor and deck enamel, and I'm painting designs on the steps. So I'd like to know if there's something I can seal it with to protect the designs.
Oh, well, that's an excellent question. I would have to say that I am not sure what exactly you'll be able to put over the particular paint that you have applied. We would generally consult with the experts at a place like Sherwin-Williams. Where did you buy your paint for the decorative painting?
I think it's an Ace product.
Okay. Well, you know, my concern would be the compatibility of, first off, the paint that you're using with the cement surface. I'll assume it is a paint that's, in fact, designed to be used on the cement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then I would recommend going to a retailer that's more of just a painting retailer where they will have a wider range of product and people with good knowledge of what they have and what those products can and can't do. And I would even recommend taking in the can of paint that you have used for the decorative painting, and they will be able to ascertain if there are likely conflicts or problems with what it is they would recommend.
Okay. Very good.
Okay.
All right.
Good luck.
Jenna, thank you very much. We appreciate your call. And we're going to pause to catch up with all of the latest news, but we'll come back and we'll take more of your calls as we talk today about home renovation and repair issues with Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company specializing in sustainable design and historic renovations. You get more about the work that Chad does at chadscarpentry.com. And John Viner of Building Services and Consultant of Mount Horb is a licensed installer for Focus on Energy. Is that correct?
I'm a certified consultant or a qualified consultant for the Focus on Energy program. Absolutely.
All right. And they'll be back after the news. We'll take more of your calls. You do that at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today for a discussion of home renovation and repair issues. And if you'd like to join in, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Talking with Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. Chad, again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you bet. It's a pleasure to be here, Jim.
And John Viner of Building Services and Consultant of Mount Horb. John, pleasure to have you with us as well.
Yeah, it's always fun to come into the studio, Jim.
At the start of the program an hour ago, we talked about two programs. September 15th is the deadline for people living in the southern half of the state with mold and water problems from that May-June storms to register with FEMA. And to do so, you go to FEMA, FEMA.gov, or you can call them at 800-621-3362. And we also talked about a program from Focus on Energy offering limited-income homeowners some low-cost efficiency improvements to improve the comfort, safety, and affordability of their homes. And it's income-restricted to under $41,300 for a family of four who are customers of participating natural gas and electricity providers. And to get information on that, you go to focusonenergy.com or you call 800-762-7077. So those are two programs we talked about earlier. We also had a telephone call from some lady who is painting some concrete steps in a high traffic area, and she wanted to know about putting a sealer on that. Barbara from Fort Wayne, Indiana, is joined in and has an answer for us. Hello, Barbara.
Good morning.
Tell us about why you have an answer. You have some experience in the field, I understand.
I managed a paint store for 30 years. It was a Benjamin Moore dealer in Fort Wayne.
Okay. So what's the answer for this lady that's got the high traffic area? She's got paint on concrete. It was, I believe, a latex enamel that she was using, and it was especially for this purpose.
Oh, then she wouldn't need to coat it at all. I only heard the end of the question, so I'm a little embarrassed that I'm answering your call. If it's a high gloss latex enamel, she told you the sheen level?
I'm sorry?
She told you the sheen level of the latex paint?
No, she didn't.
Okay. The lower the finish, the better it's going to hold up. And if it's ever on concrete, you just need to make sure that moisture isn't wicking through it.
Mm-hmm.
So the trick would be to make sure she paints all the way around the steps if she can. If the concrete is exposed to the ground at any point, are they outside or inside?
I assume they're outside, but we don't really know that for sure. Outside.
Okay.
Let's say outside.
Okay, if they're outside, I would simply do the test of putting a bath mat or a floor mat out of a car, for instance, on the surface of the paint, and leave it like overnight. If moisture wicks up through the concrete, she'll see a wet spot on the paint itself mm-hmm. when she picks the mat up. And in that case, she doesn't want to do anything because the latex paint will allow it to wick on through. Anything she does to seal over that it's just going to be more to peel off if there's moisture under there.
And if it was dry, then?
If it's dry, she could put just sand the surface very lightly and put on a latex-based polyurethane.
Okay.
To give her some durability.
We appreciate your answer.
You're welcome. Have a lovely day.
Thanks, Barbara. And let's go to Shirley next in Prentice. Shirley, what's on your mind?
Oh, thanks. I'm wondering if some type of metal screening could be put over the top of my chimney to keep bats out so they wouldn't get in there to roost. And would it deteriorate? I was thinking of something like hardware cloth, but that it'd have to be finer than that. And could how would it be fastened?
Yeah, I know those bats can squeeze through a pretty small area. Somebody, I think, told me yesterday about the size of a dime. So that's pretty darn small. I guess I would not recommend a fine mesh screen over. Is the chimney used for a fireplace? Or
It's a double chimney, both for a gas furnace, gas boiler, mm-hmm. and a wood stove, which I don't use. But once in a while, I will. So, I suppose. Well, then snow would build up, too, wouldn't it, if it was terribly very fine?
Yeah, that's right. I think dust and things would collect there, and we're going to have to get a cap that is manufactured for that chimney. I don't want to have you put anything else on top of that. Now, when you said your gas furnace and your wood fireplace use the chimney, I assume there's two different flues within
right.
that one masonry chimney.
Yes,
okay.
Uh-huh.
Great. And blocking those off, I guess, again, the answer is no. I would not recommend a fine mesh screen on top of that.
Yeah. So I guess I'm stuck with
that. Yeah, the bats, you're certain they're entering in from the chimney, huh?
What did you say?
You're certain the bats are entering down the chimney?
Occasionally, occasionally they'll slide down, and then they get into those slippery exhaust pipes, I'll call them, exhaust vents, that are probably 4 inches in diameter, one for the water heater and one for the boiler. And then they slide, they can't get back up the chimney, so they slide down, and then they're in the basement, and then they come out. I open a door, and generally they'll go out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But gives my friends kind of a squeamish feeling.
I suppose.
Yeah, I guess an answer would be looking to see what a manufacturer, fireplace, and chimney specialist has for you. And also maybe investigate how do we make effective use of those bats rather than having them come into our house. Maybe there's some techniques a bat resource individual could help you with as well.
We've built a big bat house and a couple little ones. They prefer my chimney, I guess. Thank you very much.
Shirley, thanks very much. Don't put out the coffee and cookies for them. I guess that's the answer. Patricia may have an answer for you, though. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. Yes, you can get these chimney covers with screening around. We had to do that over a metal fireplace chimney
mm-hmm.
because they would drop right down and then come into the basement. And also on the roof we have that. And I had a problem with bats. I had a new roof put on, not just the roof, but the house sided. And new gable louvers were installed. The previous ones were metal with wire screening on the back, never had a problem. Well, the new ones, I'm just warning people, if they put in these vinyl or whatever they are ones now, all they have on the back of them is kind of a material mesh. And I heard this bat in the attic. This was last year, and my son had gone in the attic in the wintertime, and yes, at one of the gables, there was a hole chewed right through there. And the bats like these louvers, these slanted louvers. They think it's a bat house, and they go right up in there.
Okay.
So that was a difficult problem. But I do have a question about a roof. When I had the new roof put on, I had new flashing around my furnace chimney and new decking. I have found there is a little bit of leakage coming in around that flashing. And this is about 5 years ago I had this put in. what would be the best way to rectify this? Just sealing around that area up on the roof, or taking off those shingles and resealing?
Well, it's going to depend really on whether or not the flashing was actually installed incorrectly, or whether just a combination of the tuck pointing and just some of the points of intersection are such that you get a little bit of water coming in, and then it might be able to be solved with some caulking products that will prevent that little bit of leaking from occurring. Has the original contractor been responsive at all to the?
No, he told me, oh, everything was sealed up really tightly.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear that. I would recommend that you find a credible roofing contractor in your area, and have them come out and take a look at it. Generally, something like that, unless it's really egregious, can be solved with a variety of roof caulking products that should prevent water from continuing to come into the home.
Products for that, a certain type one should look for?
Well, there's a product that we use. It's called tri-polymer sealant. It's designed for contact with masonry, metal, and asphalt surfaces. So it's a very flexible, high temperature range from cold to, you know, from sub-zero to very hot conditions, all of which are necessary in a roof environment in Wisconsin. So this is a very high performance caulk and roof sealant, and that's typically what we would use. I'm not sure if it can be obtained anywhere other than some of the wholesalers. I have not noticed this product at some of the big box stores or at the hardware store. There are some products at the hardware store. There's an asphalt-based caulk product called Blackjack, which can be used in conjunction with asphalt shingles, and that is widely available. So you may have to go to your local store and ask some questions about the various caulks, because if you go someplace with a wide variety, I mean, it can be overwhelming if you don't know exactly what you're looking for.
Thank you very much.
You're
all
welcome.
Right, Patricia, thank you very much for your call. 1-800-642-1234. Let's take care of some emails. Phil in Middleton bought a house a few years ago in Middleton, a Cape Cod, does not have eaves and overhangs. Every year he's had ice dams, and there's some damage visible in the dining room to the front of the house. His question is, what exactly is happening with ice damming?
Okay, I think I can take that. A lot of my time is spent this last year working with homeowners and contractors on helping to solve and prevent the ice damming. So the ice dams, obvious, is after the snow falls, hits the roof. The heat from the house is melting the snow at a relatively rapid rate, and that snow, once it's melted, obviously turns the water, runs down to the eave, and freezes where it's cold once again. So heat loss is a major component of the formation of that ice dam. So when we go out and do energy auditing services, this type of problem solving is right up our alley, right? Mm-hmm. We're understanding that heat flow in and out of our building assemblies. So we want to prevent that ice dam by maximizing the insulation that our structure gives us, or if we're planning larger renovations such as roofing projects, they're an ideal time to really upgrade the thermal values and the air tightness values within our building structure. And often, unfortunately, large ice dams can necessitate let's do the roof sooner rather than later so we can be assured it doesn't return. Attic venting plays a large role, and with that older Cape Cod house, we don't have that overhang. We don't really have a structure that we can ventilate through those cavities really well. And often through those slope ceilings up in that Cape Cod, if it's a 2x4 wall cavity and a rafter, venting that diminishes our value. So we are ending up filling those cavities completely and often eliminating venting if we can get an effective insulation installation that provides an airtight barrier in the same step.
Now, in his situation, he doesn't have the overhang, and so can he blow or lay insulation in there to change this in any way, or does it require that he start at that roof edge?
The laying the insulation or blowing insulation in always should be seen as a second or third step, or a fourth step. Let's not go there right off the bat. First, we need a blower door test and an air tightness test. The evaluations provided through the Home Performance with Energy Star program so that we're not guessing. We test so we don't have to guess. That's our, you know, what needs to be completed. We understand how that structure is working from its air tightness, where is the air and heat escaping.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the tools, the blower door test, which is a large fan we put on the exterior doorway of the home, we exhaust air out of the house, we force air to come in every crack, hole, and seam that there is. It's a very definitive tool in understanding airflow and hence heat loss. As well as another tool is an infrared camera, helping us again to very definitively understand insulation levels and integrity within hidden spaces. So that evaluation is key, and it's without it, we're just guessing. So I'd direct them there first to the Focus on Energy program.
Focus on Energy, you can just Google that, look it up in the phone book. It is a quasi-government and industry group intended to help homeowners with better efficiency in their homes, correct?
Absolutely.
All right. Back to the phones to Turner in Menominee. Hello, Turner.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have a question regarding re-roofing our porches. We have a front and a back porch on our house, and I don't know if there's any advantage to ventilating those spaces. Is there any reason to do that or any advantage to ventilating a porch roof?
Is it conditioned? The porch, if the porches are unconditioned, then it certainly becomes less important for us to ventilate those roofs.
Okay. The rear porch through a kitchen remodel is now mostly conditioned space. So the front porch just has an entry vestibule, which we don't really heat. We just keep the doors closed all the time. So I guess the front porch then wouldn't be one to worry about. But you're saying the back porch, we might want to consider ventilating that area?
Yeah, anywhere we're going to insulate, if even in that entryway, if we have fiberglass or other insulating material in that ceiling and that room is often open to the house, once we insulated within those attic spaces, those attics are going to get colder if we have any risks at all of moisture transport into those spaces because they, you know, they are connected or the doorway remains open, then venting is a good thing wherever we're going to insulate.
And how is that typically done? Because it's our porches are, you know, basically a shed roof that comes off the front and the back of the house. So what type of a vent could we use that's aesthetically pleasing? So, it's, I mean, on the front porch, you're gonna see these vents when you look at the house.
Right. So in that, at the front of the house, it is a shed-style roof as well. Are there little gable ends on the sides?
Yeah, there are.
You know, where we're, at a minimum, we're getting a little vent back to some of those louvered vents we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And at each side.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, it's a hip roof, so the whole perimeter is at the same level. So,
mm-hmm.
So there isn't any kind of a gable exposed on the porch part of the roof.
Right.
It's all tied up to the house.
It gets a little bit more difficult when we have that hip roof, and that appearance certainly is a factor that we have to work with. There's any overhangs there?
Yeah, there are overhangs.
So you can have a little bit of venting at the eaves.
Right.
There is a product called a drip edge vent that I've had some success with. So this is, there's a drip edge when after when we re-roof at the edge of the roof,
right.
That is has some designed holes in it to allow venting into that attic space.
Okay.
A drawback to that is potentially it could be covered up with snow and ice in Wisconsin's winter, and will it stay open and clear? Probably not 100% of the time.
Okay.
But it's a product to consider and take a look at.
And good luck to you, Turner. Appreciate your call. Another emailer with a question from Kelly, whose husband heard some time ago there was a code regulation prohibiting third floors in residences in Dane County. Anything about that, Chad?
Well, third floors are tricky. There are a variety of zoning regulations which make it pretty difficult to create a finished space in the third floor of a residential home. There are some exceptions to that. It has to do with the pitch of the roof, and you can't tear the roof off and rebuild it in a way that allows for such a renovation. Essentially, we're talking about existing structures,
mm-hmm.
In places where essentially the zoning allows for two-story structures, potentially over finished or walkout basements, but two structures above grade. So all I can really say is that there are definitely a variety of roadblocks and hurdles, but some people are fortunate to have structures which accommodate some finishing in that third floor if that's their desire.
Let's go to Sean in Mountain next. Hi, Sean.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, I have a lot of condensation that forms on my windows during the winter months. I have a 35-year-old home, family of five, but we have no exhaust fan in our bathroom. And I was wondering how much impact that would have on reducing the condensation by installing one of those.
Hard to gauge the impact, though we know it's a basic necessity is to have that bath fan installed. It does fall back to how much moisture we are producing within the home and trying to first and foremost identify those sources, reduce them if we can, eliminate them is best if there's sources that we can remove. Then we want to go to ventilation. The bath fan, certainly, it could go a long ways. Hard to tell from here. Though it's a 35-year-old house, window quality plays a role, as well as tightness level of that structure. So if you have a very a tight home or a modestly tighter building, we are holding moisture in that structure, which can aggravate these problems. I would recommend getting the house tested again so we understand the tightness level of the house and the other dynamics as far as moisture generation in the home to make a real solid recommendation. Though we know we need a bath fan. We know we can take that step.
Start there with step one, Sean. Thanks very much for your call. I'm sorry we can't get to more of the calls. The time has flown. And I want to thank John Viner for being here today. Look forward to seeing you in a couple of months.
Thank you, Jim.
And Chad Spate, good traveling today as he returns from Baltimore and comes back to work. Thank you, Chad.
Yes, thank you, Jim.
Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Carpentry. Again, his website is chadscarpentry.com. And John Viner doesn't have a website that's working, but you can contact him by email, john@homeperformancetesting.net. Thanks very much. And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Tomorrow, we'll have Lori Skelton in, and she will be talking about garden talk, and I hope that you're listening here on the Ideas Net.